The unimaginable brutality of war. Two young athletes near death and miraculously brought back to life. A forged alliance between a country priest from Kansas and a cosmopolitan Italian canon lawyer at the cost of $500,000. These are just a few of the puzzle pieces joined by New York Times bestselling author and investigative journalist Joe Drape to reveal what has been cloaked in secrecy throughout the course of history. In his new book, The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith, Drape takes readers deep inside the Vatican to meet the priests and cardinals, lawyers, doctors, and laypeople who have the power to elevate a person of deep faith and goodness to the highest ranks of holiness, sainthood. In the process, he sheds light on a much larger question: can such a person reliably be proven to exist? Joe Drape is an award-winning sports writer for the New York Times. He's author of six books, including Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen, and American Pharaoh, The Untold Story of the Triple Crown Winner's Legendary Rise. The new book is The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. Joe, thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me back again. You've been very supportive of these side projects.
Well, first of all, you're just such a great writer, and I enjoy your work very, very much. Let me ask you this question about what drew you to this particular side project, of what it was that tapped you on the shoulder and said, oh, this is something to investigate.
You know, Joe, what happened was all my previous books have been sports. Sports is my main thing. You know, about 2015, an editor had done one of my sports books, said, have you ever thought about stepping out and trying something different, non-sports? And I said, yeah. And he goes, what do you have? And I had come up with the protagonist of this book is a priest in Kansas named Father Emil Capon. He was a military chaplain, the most decorated in Army history, was given awarded the Medal of Honor in 2013. And there was a push to make him a saint. And I had stumbled upon him when I was back in Kansas living for another book about a high school football team. And I saw how much he resonated with the people of that region. And the reason was he was a farmer. He was a man of action. He wasn't a great talker. He was a man of character and principles. And they had really claimed him as his own and had prayed to him. And they were full behind him on trying to become a saint. So that was the notion that just stuck with me for about 8 years. And then I grew up parochial educated, Jesuit high school, and I had no idea how you made a saint. So I started down that path. I wanted to know how many saints there were, what was the process. And what I discovered in all this is a sort of long Byzantine process of, somewhat based in mainly based in divinity, but had modern considerations like politics, power, and money had come into the system as well. Hmm. So, you know, that is how I started down this path. I had a great story to tell about a great man. I had this process that I was curious about as being a Catholic. And then the third component, as I was moving along, I realized that, you know, the third component I needed was a better spiritual life. And so I had to start thinking and investigating where I had come as someone who had a conversation or not a very good conversation with a higher power.
So one of the points that you make, you were just mentioning money and power, but one of the points that you make in the book is that making that case for sainthood takes a lot of time, and it does. It takes a lot of money. It's very expensive.
Yeah, Joe, what the average length of time that elapses between a candidate's death and his canonization is 181 years. But recently in modern times, the evolution has that is you could short circuit a bit if you have celebrity and if you have power. Father Capon, they already have $600,000 into that effort. Causes have gone up to $1 million. At the same time, the Vatican, mainly because of Pope John Paul II, he realized saint making was an underutilized tool for marketing and PR, that you could meet people where they lived if you gave them somebody to imitate. The two components of a saint is virtuous life, worth imitating, but even more important is relatable. We need to see a little bit of ourselves in this. And, you know, the geopolitics and the demographics dictate another path. You know, Latin America, the Catholic Church was losing the faithful there to evangelicals and missionaries. So he decided, you know, he needed to ramp up sort of a superhero, a solar system of superheroes, which is basically what saints are in the Catholic Church, and give people somebody to look up to reach them. And so, you know, he was a well-traveled guy. He went to more countries than all of his previous predecessors, spoke 8 languages, liked being out in front of people. And he literally would pick up the phone and call the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints and say, you know, who do we have in the pipeline in South America? And, you know, he made it the system a little shorter. And when he first got there, it took 4 miracles. And we're talking about that to get over the hump into canonization. He moved it down to 2 miracles.
So when it comes to Father Coppin, it's fascinating because here is a man who dies in a prison camp at the age of 35. So he has led a very short life.
A short, power-packed life. He found his calling as a chaplain. He served in World War II, earned a Bronze Star there. He goes to Korea, and that's the other thing I discovered, is Korea was a short and largely forgotten and very brutal war. Within 2 weeks of him landing there with his battalion, 25,000 Chinese troops descended on him. And, you know, his heroics and derring do made the Saturday Evening Post of that day. He would drive his Jeep just recklessly and fearlessly, not making sure not to leave men behind while bombs were going off and they were shooting at him. On the battlefield in those 2 weeks, he saved hundreds of soldiers. When they got captured, the Chinese marched him 60 miles over a month in sub-freezing temperature, and he carried a wounded man on his shoulders the whole way. And he rallied everybody around him to pick up the wounded, because the wounded would be shot and left behind if they couldn't keep moving. So he immediately established himself as the leader by example. And when he got to the prison camp, he just elevated his game in the sense that everything he had done before then came into use. He was a farmer's son, so he knew how to make things. He made pans. He made tools. He made commodes, latrines. He was a man's man, and he would go steal food from the guards just to feed them. All they had were basically a fistful of birdseed. Millet is what they call. And he'd go forage and scavenge food. He kept their hopes up. It wasn't just the Catholics either. That was the thing that was really impressive about him. He was universally liked by the Turk soldiers who were Muslims, the Jewish, the Protestant, the atheist. He would spend his time with everybody. And the most he would say is, "Do you got time for a little prayer?" And that was, you know, basically his religion. So he established himself to such a degree in this prison camp that the Chinese guards feared him. They didn't want anything to do with him, that he would be able to wander it at will, even though they were aiming rifles at him, telling him not to. And when he finally got sick, as all everybody else, I mean, 700 soldiers died in camp number 5 where he was, just from conditions. And he finally took ill himself. The Chinese saw it as an opportunity. They came to get him. His men rallied, tried to riot. And he said, no, guys, I'm going where I want to. I want to be with my Father in heaven. And as they carried him out, he gave the sign of the cross and asked all those Chinese soldiers that were taking him to his death to forgive him. So, you know, he lived a life of Christ right down to his final breath.
When it comes to sainthood, you make the point that there are some 10,000 saints, though many never really existed. And they were from mythical times. So you talk about how, as you just mentioned, miracles are a big part of this. So it went from 4 to 2. For Father Coppin's case, what were the two miracles that were decided upon?
The two miracles that they are presenting have to do with young athletes in Kansas. One was a pole vaulter who missed the pit, cracked his skull literally in half, was unconscious, basically told he either was going to die or live in a vegetative state. The two components of a miracle, Joe, is first, it has to be a remarkable recovery, but the most important is somebody has to pray to the Saint candidate and ask for his help. And so what happened with Chase, Kier is his name, is his family filled the hospital, his parish went and had prayer lines, all saying prayers to Father Coppin, asking for his help. They even put a Facebook page up that got hundreds and thousands of hits of other people praying for him. He recovers remarkably after 30 days, rehabs faster than anybody thought. And, you know, in the church's eyes, what that proves is that Father Coppin was in heaven with Christ. And when they prayed to him, he had enough pull to intercede and save Chase. And the second case is just as remarkable. It was a 12-year-old girl, Avery Girlman, who collapsed on a soccer field one day, rushed to the hospital, was there 87 days, most of it on a ventilator and on a kidney, had organs had failed, so they had to put her on a dialysis machine. Nobody really knew what it was. Only later they'd figure out it was an autoimmune disease. And they basically unplugged her, thinking, okay, let nature take its course. And she started breathing on her own immediately. Then she started recognizing people, and then she started talking. And sort of the cool twist there is her time in that hospital, it was Wesley Medical Center in Wichita, made her want to be a nurse. And she ended up, you know, she's 28 right now. She ended up going to nursing school and went back and worked there in pediatric care with some of the nurses who had helped her.
Joe Drape is our guest. The name of the new book is The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. I do want to get to your journey of faith, but I do also want to get, of course, to the fact that, as you mentioned, you were talking about Pope John Paul II, making that process easier. He canonized 482 saints, more than all of his predecessors combined in the previous 600 years. And so his own legacy is now, as this book comes out, is under question because of the most recent McCarrick report. How does that figure into it of really the state overall of the Catholic Church and what and who we believe at this point?
Well, I think the Catholic Church and the Vatican will take a step back after this. I mean, there was a reason why it took so long and why it should take so long. It should be a rigorous process. Now, Pope John Paul, as soon as he died, there were people outside the Vatican demanding and chanting to make him a saint. He went through in 9 years, which is impossible. And even more impossible is Mother Teresa went in 5 years. Now, that really should shine the light on the fact that celebrity has a great thing to do with it. And those two are unparalleled celebrities in the Catholic Church. But, you know, 9 years, and now we're only, what, less than 20 years after that? Nobody's been stripped of his sainthood, but it's going to make them think twice to see if their legacy can endure the test of time. And I think that is what's happened here. But at the same time, the parallel case, Joe, is just in recent weeks, a 15-year-old Italian boy, Carlo Secuto, was beatified, putting him, that means one miracle was accepted. He's one miracle away from being a saint. And he died tragically of leukemia in 2006. And he's been fast-tracked to this point. And again, this sort of has to do with the marketing of the church. He's known, his renown was he went viral because he was a teenage computer-savvy kid who would track down miracles on the internet. So, you know, I think they turned an eye to that. And I'm not diminishing his case. I'm sure he lived a virtuous life and the miracles are in order. But I think, again, they jumped ahead and said, it's probably good business to have a cyber millennial saint to reflect that we are a modern church. So, you know, those they're going to have to wrestle with those kinds of decisions and how you balance, I guess, the old school way of rigor versus the immediate needs to keep up with the times.
In Father Coppin's case, you touch on this, and I'm interested in your thoughts about how much does the fact that he is an American have to do with it? The fact that that American priests are often seen as being responsible for the sexual abuse crisis, and also that he was a soldier.
All three of those things, it was made very clear to me, are not going to deny him, but there's no hurry to do anything with him. First of all, there's only seven American saints in all of time. All of them are women, and only two were actually born on American soil. There's no rush to please the American church from the Vatican. In fact, half the saints are Italian, and that's a home field advantage, definitely. They're still angry, and it was made very clear that they blamed the sexual abuse scandal on the American church. And, you know, they no hurry to call attention to that. He is a military man, okay? I don't think that just doesn't resonate in the rest of the world in light of the way we have wielded power in modern times. And the third thing is, you know, he's a hero to the heartland and to farmers and to simple people and to men in military. Now, that's not a global demographic. It's a valid demographic. It's a demographic that should be recognized. But right now, the emphasis is on, and I was told this, is Asia and Africa, because they want to make inroads there. So he's not going to move to the front of any line, but he's going to get a fair hearing.
I was moved by a book that was written 10, 12 years ago by James Carroll called Practicing Catholic, of what it is like to kind of try to find meaning from the historical and the social and the religious of as a person and dealing with one owns Catholicism. And as a Catholic, I you know, that word practicing seems just right to me because, you know, you keep trying. For you, what were the stumbling blocks in the sense of the obstacles that got in the way of you going forward of learning of what a spiritual life could be?
You know, and practicing is an excellent word, and thank you, and I will steal that for future questions on that. Frankly, Joe, I forgot how to practice. What was not connecting with the material. You know, I try to lead a good life, but something was missing. And in the book, since I'm a sports writer, I said, I'm like a golfer who's got the yips, and all of a sudden I can't hit a two-foot putt. And something was just off. And I went and read all the old stuff that I grew up with. I looked into Thomas Merton. I went and talked to people who were older and who were happy and were deeply into their faith and tried everything and anything. You know, I went out and reported out as what is a happy faith spiritual life. And one day I was with having lunch with Father Jim Martin, a Jesuit writer and editor. You may have had him on your show before. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Do you pray?" And it kind of took me aback. And I was like, "Yes." And he goes, "How?" And I said, "You know, Our Fathers, Hail Marys, the usual stuff." And he goes, "What do you pray for?" And I was like, "Nothing really." And he kind of put his fork down and he said, "You know, if your son was troubled or worried about something, wouldn't you want him to come to you?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know, that's what God is like, or your your higher power. He wants us to come and talk to him and have a dialogue with him. And, you know, I was embarrassed there first, and then I'm afraid to admit this now. And he goes, have you tried praying to Father Capone? And I'd lived with this guy 8 years, and it had never occurred to me to do that. And, you know, that was sort of the moment that practicing your right is a good word. I hadn't been present enough. And what the whole process has taught me is to be present, to recognize the goodness in others, and to try to be good yourself. And the Jesuits have a prayer or an exercise, actually, called the Examen, and they do it 3 times a day. But it's a series of 7 questions that basically say, you know, when did you feel close to Christ? What did you do today to feel close to Christ? When did you turn away from Christ? And those 7 questions, I fail that test every day. It's really hard to be practiced. And, you know, that was the other thing. Being a saint's really hard. And what's even really hard is just trying to be good to those around you and your community, and just try not to be self-absorbed all the time. So that's where I've came out of it. And, you know, I'm by no means saved, and I haven't answered those questions any better than I did before. But at least I recognize it's worth the effort to try to pursue an authentic spiritual life. So
My grandfather's brother was a bishop in New York and was a regular, because my grandfather was a commissioner of racing in New York, and I remember going with the bishop to Saratoga, and I was very young, and we went in, my dad, myself, and the bishop, and we went in, and I said, "What are we going to do?" And the bishop said, "I'm going to teach you how to pray." So
that's my kind of bishop right there.
Right. Well, and I think of that every time I go to Saratoga. But it does. But of course, one of the issues is coming to the social terms of what is happening within the priesthood, what's happening within the religion, and often the stances that the church has taken. And when you talk about fast-tracking of saints, I mean, fast-tracking is really not something that is thought of in the Catholic Church. It takes a really long time to change most things. And was that a hiccup for you? Because I know it's a hiccup for me. I think it's a hiccup for a lot of people that you say, okay, I'm in on this, but I do have trouble. And you find yourself kind of shopping for the priest in the neighborhood who you can sit down on a Sunday and get through a sermon without your head exploding.
You're right, Joe. And that's one hiccup, and there's many hiccups.
Absolutely.
And the hiccups are still there for me. And I have kind of distilled it to this. When I was growing up, at least, there was a cafeteria Catholic, buffet Catholic, an a la carte Catholic. It was used as a pejorative, like, oh, you only want to do the things that are convenient to you. And I think that paradigm has shifted. And I think I'm proudly a cafeteria Catholic because I'm still Catholic despite the things they do that I don't agree with. And, you know, they ought to be glad I'm in the church, too. And there's an old friend of mine, Bob Berner, who's pushing 90 and very devout and has been involved in the Diocese of Chicago and all kinds of things, and, you know, has found peace. And he said, "Well, you got to remember is we're the church. The people are the church. They're an organization in a hierarchy that has been there for centuries of old men, and they are slow to change, and they have one world view. But me and you, Joe, we're the church, and we can, that's the important aspect of it."
And we want to believe in saints. Sometimes it's hard, but we want to believe in that.
Yeah, we do, because you do want some example. But you want to, and this is the thing that I keep coming back to, you want to see a little bit of yourself in there. You know, I would like to think that I am from that region of the country, and if I was faced with incredible hardship, that my character would stand up to it in much the same way as Father Capon, not with all the heroics and, you know, all that, but I would be able to look it in the eye and be a comfort to those around me. And I think that's what saints are about, is finding somebody that reminds you that the faith, your faith is good. It's good to have a faith. Mm. And that if you can do it, if they could do it, you could do it.
Well, the book is just terrific. It is The Saint Makers Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith, that is published by Hachette. Joe Drape, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for the time. Have a beautiful holiday season.
You too, and hopefully we'll see each other in the spa this summer. I missed it.
Joe Drape is the author of The Saint Makers Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.